Mini episode 1822 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1822. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris coming at you. And for the first time, we are going live here in the FDH Lounge. We are doing this here tonight to do a preview, or a review, I should say. That's what happens when you go without a net, folks. Sometimes you accidentally say review instead of, or preview instead of review, for The White Lotus season 3. FDH Lounge dignitary Ben Chu joining me in a second, and I'm going to explain, when he comes on, why we're doing this one live. We are working out the bugs for a project that we are going to have coming up subsequently. So you may be checking us out right now, potentially on our YouTube channel at the FDH Lounge. We can also be found as we are live streaming this right now on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Twitch. And we are going to be getting into everything with The White Lotus season 3. Our thoughts on the finale, our thoughts on everything that transpired leading up to it, what kind of a season that it was. Ben and I have certainly been exchanging a lot of thoughts as we've been going along through the season off air, and now we get to do so on air as I bring in my man, FDH Lounge dignitary Ben Chu. As I've said previously, generally on in his capacity as FDH Hoops analyst, but sometimes on to talk some other things, frequently great TV shows. And right now, on to talk The White Lotus Season 3 and the finale that we just saw. Ben, welcome to the program, my man.
Well, I'm back again, Rick. How are you?
I'm great, buddy. How are you doing?
Doing good today. Excited to talk White Lotus Season 3 finale today.
I'm excited as well. I'm excited to get to test out our live platform here. And again, we are doing this to kind of try to work out the bugs, as it were. We have coming up later in the month, I've kind of teased this a little bit here, we are going to be live streaming for the NFL draft. It's going to be the FDH Lounge Pro Football Coast to Coast Draft Show. So Ben being out there in Portland is a good example of the Coast to Coast. Us here on America's North Coast in Cleveland, and points a number of different places in between. So that is going to be really awesome to get to do, Ben. And that's where, again, we're getting to see what this is going to be like a little bit here. So it's a pleasure to have you in for this. Thank you for being here for the test, as it were, and for an actual show that we're doing at the same time.
Well, of course. And I think also, too, with the NFL draft coming up, hopefully we won't have any crossover for White Lotus. But, hey, you never know these days. So
you never know. You never know. And we're going to be having a host of the greats through the course of the night here. And I'm going to be sort of, as we go through, sort of experimenting with some features, bringing them in here. One of the things that I haven't done subsequently is screen sharing. So hopefully this ends up working. And so what I want to do is I want to be able to bring up here a picture, because we are dedicating our NFL draft night coverage to two of our recently fallen FDH Lounge dignitaries. And this is a picture that was taken just last September, shockingly so, that it was this recent under the circumstances here. Me and a couple of the fellas from the show going down to catch a live rendition of the Dumb Zone podcast. Great show out of Dallas. Dan McDowell, who I worked in public radio with many, many moons ago, WOUB down in Athens, moving their show off of The Ticket in Dallas, what had been the Hang Zone, to now the Dumb Zone there. And a great show, great comedy show. They took it on the road for the Browns and the Cowboys week one game last fall, and they were up in town doing the show, and I got with me Ken Detweiler, my good friend. You see him on the outside to the right in this picture. Anthony Petrone, you see him to the outside to the left in the picture, and Matt Petrone right over my right shoulder as you're looking at this here. And unfortunately, in the span of 18 days, out of the four folks in this picture, it's just me and Matt that are left. First, Ken Detweiler shockingly passing away back on March 20th. And then just yesterday, as we are taping this, April 6th, the sad culmination of Anthony's brave fight against cancer subsequently here. So we will be dedicating our NFL Draft Night show to these guys, two of our great FDH Lounge dignitaries. And I am just, as we bring it back in here now with me and Ben, again, just two great guys who embodied the show, the wit and the wisdom and everything like that. Two of the fellows going back to the old Sports Talk Network days, as you did, Ben Chu.
And, I mean, Anthony was a great human being, and at this time, too, you know, thoughts are with his family. And overall, I hope we can do them justice for the NFL Draft Show.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. This is a show that those fellas from the next realm here will be sitting back and enjoying it greatly. And yeah, it's going to be a great honor to get to do a show in their honor. And so this show here, mini episode 1822, is sort of preparing, as like I said, working out the bugs on the fly here as far as doing a live stream. And taking a look at the White Lotus season 3. And this is the thing where, again, you and I have background on this show, of course, and anthology. You and I have watched the past two seasons. You got into this show at my urging. And it's a show where season 1 set in Hawaii. That was a show that was basically set around more or less class differences, as it were. Season 2, which was set in Sicily, was a season that was based around largely sex and issues of lust. Season 3 being set in Thailand, going with almost sort of the cliche Eastern mysticism kind of a deal here, set around spirituality and whatnot. And something that I had remarked to you during the course of the season is there was the way that season 3 played out. In a way, it would have been more fitting if it was season 2 with the sex theme, because I would say edging really kind of seemed to be the theme here, because there were a couple of episodes where they seemed to be promising that we were going to have big things happening. Both of the nighttime episodes, I believe it was episodes 5 and 7, it seemed to be building towards, oh, we're going to get some big things happening here. Somebody might die. And at that point, it was still basically just world building. So it was a strange approach to the season. It did lead to an action-packed finale, as we knew that it would be, but it was not the structure that I was expecting coming in, nor perhaps the structure that I might have preferred, Ben.
Right, and I think the question more with this season 2 is also had an extended episode count. Season 1 had only 6. Season 2 had 7, and this had 8. And there were at times, like, because I am a huge White Lotus fan, that, again, there were moments where it was a little slow, and the pacing was kind of off, and it felt like there were times when Mike White, the creator, was trying to shoehorn in as many storylines as humanly possible just to make sure that we have, you know, action-packed scenarios. And again, too, it was a very interesting season just in terms of storytelling and how, you know, things are framed, and just a lot of shot, a lot of nature shots, which, as you remember from seasons 1 and season 2, it was a little bit less subdued. Yes. So there's a little bit, there was an interesting season overall, and it did have a finale with a lot of stuff happening. And it almost felt like, too, that we've discussed this, like, really great TV sometimes have seasons that are a little, that run a little too long. And it felt like at times this one probably should have been just 7 episodes, and they probably could have cut a little bit more. And there was even stuff that Mike White has even said himself that they had to leave on the cutting room floor because they just didn't have time to add to these episodes.
I can believe that. I can definitely believe that that's the case, because just the way that they were going through everything. Again, the pacing was different having two more episodes in the course of the season. And I just felt like, again, it might have been a little bit of kind of stretching to kind of get through, because it was not as urgent of a pace as we saw in the first two seasons here. And it built to a finale where, and again, and this is a spoilered review of this, so there will be, you know, details galore as far as what happened. But what was interesting is that by the time that, you know, nighttime happened on that last full day at the White Lotus, you didn't have a whole lot of certainty at that point. You had the certainty that the father wasn't going to kill the family. The Ratliffs were going to live, if the father had anything to say about it, which he almost didn't, and we'll get to that. And that the girls on the girls' trip here, that they had basically reconciled with one another, and that their story was basically told. But there was so much yet to come in the next day. So it's one of those things where they not only waited till the last episode, they waited till the last, I don't know, third of the episode or whatever it would be to really get to a lot of the resolution. They really took their time, even in the finale, getting to all of the things that needed to happen.
Right. And this is not a knock on Mike White. I thought it was a really, really good season. But there was a lot of storylines that kind of were, to use the best analogy, like, I've seen this in like mystery novels. I was like trying to wrap up loose ends as much as humanly possible. And I think sometimes that is a weakness sometimes of TV in comparison to books, is that while we can be provided the justification for do it in TV, you really can't. Like you had to essentially end the storyline because there would not be another book. There would not be another scenario. So I feel like just overall too, it was like, it was a very, I thought at times, up and down season, a lot of, like you said, leading the viewer to a point to where something happened. And it feels like too that it was a great sort of finale, 90 minutes, but it was also too, like, there were, like you said, the girls trip storyline didn't really have much. The whole thing with essentially, you know, Zion and his mother to Belinda is just kind of also, there was plot there, but it also, it felt like it was paced quickly, that they needed to make sure we got this done at the end of the day. And then essentially too, like there were times when, you know, Guy Talk's character and Mook, Lisa Mandelbaum from Blackpink, essentially they were around, but also it didn't really have much of a plot line at that point too. But again, so I feel like we're being very critical of it because this is such a great series. But at the same point, too, I think this is one of those things where you try to tell a lot of stories from a lot of different perspectives, and it felt like there was a little bit of an overrun.
Yeah, I felt like there was, too. And I have a point about the girls' trip here that I think might be a little bit kind of controversial here, because I was reading Reddit afterwards. I was listening to some YouTube breakdowns of it, and everybody seemed to be painting it as this kumbaya kind of a moment here, that with what Lori had to say to Jacqueline and to Kate, and kind of a reconciling moment. And yes, there was that moment where Jacqueline, before Lori came down, you know, for breakfast, it did apologize to her for the Valentine thing, did kind of own up to it there. But it was one of those things where, like, she clearly felt forced to do that, right, at that point in time, that, like, this wasn't something Jacqueline was going to let go, so what do I have to say to get rid of this? Like, I'm differing from what everybody was saying about this, and maybe, to be honest with you, I mean, we all bring our different perspectives to this as we're watching it, and for me and my life, as I circle back to talking about at the beginning of the show here with Anthony Patrone, Ken Detweiler, the friends that we just lost to the next realm here, as well as my good friend Matt Patrone. I look at everybody around me. I look at you, Ben Chu. I look at this like, we don't treat each other the way those women treated each other. You know, the cattiness, the passive aggressiveness of the first couple episodes. This feels like gaslighting to me. I'm sitting here saying, I realize I'm the bad guy, but I'm saying Lori's a cuck. Like, how does she just, like, oh, I'm just so happy to be suckling at the teat of you two. I mean, I don't deny that she probably is legitimately talking about her own insecurities and everything like that, and that some of that might have been coming out of her. But it's one of these things, too, where it just, I don't know if it's that the writing was disingenuous, the story that they were trying to tell or whatever, but in the first couple episodes, it was always, remember, it was like the two of them kind of ganging up on the other one when they weren't there. And like they, it was basically this triple threat, as you would say in wrestling, of where the two against one behind the other one's back. And then this all gets basically retroactively kind of wiped aside. I could have seen an ending that was more along the lines of say the, you know, the two couples from season two in the White Lotus, one where Aubrey Plaza's character and her husband of where like they got together at the end again, as did the other couple, but it was like basically because they more or less had to. And you know, season one with Shane and his wife, I mean, they did, but it was, and they swallowed it, but they just sort of like kept going. Like that would have made more sense here of a thing of like, okay, well, I don't want there to be any weirdness at the end of the trip, whatever. But like, as far as Lori went with the whole heartfelt kind of a thing, I'm just so happy and grateful to be here at the table. I don't know. Miss me with that stuff, Ben. I wasn't feeling it.
I think there was a lot of character building of Lori throughout the entire season. And I feel like one of the issues, too, that they ran into is that I think she was almost goaded a little bit into hooking up at some point with one of the Russians, essentially, at that period of time, or not the Russians, but the Valentine.
Ukrainians, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So essentially what I felt like was that was just a culmination of her character realizing that she's going through a lot of things and just had to get that out, because in a way, too, I think we saw in earlier parts of the season, it was still a lot of essentially repression, not really a lot of, you know, saying what she believed, not until certain points or certain things. Again, it felt like, as I felt like watching that scene, is like this was a way of Mike White who's trying to just culminate everything with that character, with those characters.
Sure.
And kind of essentially putting them in a situation, as we all saw at the end with the shootout scene, where they had to be involved, and this is how, the husband is somehow at the resort because of this reason. So this is, it's kind of a, you know, it was a little bit of Deus Ex Machina essentially at that period of time. And it felt like, I don't think it didn't feel ingenuous, but disingenuous, but it felt more like the characters have run their course and this was just kind of a culmination more than anything else. It was almost also felt like too that Mike wanted a happy ending for that group on some level, whether it was
He did. And I hear you on that. But additionally, let me just posit this, that it's one of those things where, and I'd seen people point this out on Reddit, and sometimes this is where, there's a lot of leeway, I think, that we give to the White Lotus because of the quirkiness of the show and everything like that. But the way that people would be reacting in the immediate aftermath of something, a mass shooting, five people are dead, and like the girls group just, you know, as you're looking at them as they're leaving, they sort of revert back to the whole thing of like, oh, the three friends have reconciled. Like none of them would be there like, holy crap, what did we just see? I'm gonna have to go through 6 months of therapy. I almost died, you know, like Saxon, you know, the word had probably gotten back to him. I think the word had probably gotten out on the resort here. And, you know, Chloe, who he had bonded with in whatever weird kind of a way, but she made enough of an impression on him to where he was still reading that book. So, I mean, the whole thing, as far as the aftermath of it, they had the story that they wanted to tell, which is showing how everybody kind of moves forward in their lives here. But to do that, it requires erasing what the human response would be for people who are just in the midst of a mass shooting at their resort.
Right. And I think one of the issues too is that you get kind of forced as a, in a way to how we like to wrap up series or seasons for a TV series. Like there's always plot lines that they have to put in and then the characters will react a little bit oddly or differently than what we would think of in real life. And I feel like, too, it's like there was almost a period of timeline where it was recognized that shootout did happen. But it also at the time I was not, it was more about wrapping up these other storylines more than anything else. And I feel like too, the issue that they run into a lot, that drama TV runs into a lot, is having to wrap up storylines. And when you have to wrap up storylines, then that can impact your, you know, the plot lines. It can affect pacing. It can affect all these things. I mean, and again, I feel like we're being more difficult. I've seen, we saw things like this in Severance season one, as well as like this trying to get to an end point. And again, it's the question I think too is that the big one for me too, just as a viewer and fan of the show, is just watching is like, could we have just dialed back this a little bit and said, you know, we just really need like three sort of storylines instead of what we got was almost six at periods of time. So, like, would it have been better that way? Is it better to have different viewpoints? Is it better than having different things? It's just, it felt like it was a great finale, but the thing that also, it did feel a little forced at times. And that's not a negative thing. It's just more like, you have to wrap up everything in this finale, so we have to get all these storylines completed.
Well, and what's funny is that, of course, we saw... over the past weekend here, all the memes when Duke choked in the Final Four here with Tim and the Duke t-shirt that he kept wearing. Duke supposedly, as a university, had objected to the portrayal in this thing that, you know, you're showing a guy that's about to off his whole family. We don't appreciate having our name associated with that. If I'm not mistaken, I think I remember the drug lorazepam also objecting to the way that that drug was being portrayed through the course of the series. And this is something I saw on Reddit too. And again, not to nitpick, but if we're going to look at reality here, the level of withdrawal that Victoria would have been going through with that, had she, you know, really, really, really had to quit it cold turkey for as addicted as they were showing her at the beginning of the week. I mean, maybe it's a thing where like, I think we're supposed to be led to believe that she had a secret stash. I don't know why she would have been, you know, that as PO'd as she was on the boat that day when she lost the stash to, and she didn't realize it, Tim. But, you know, she, I guess, if you know, I talk to you about sometimes doing my own headcanon. They're forcing me to use some headcanon here in the sense of, like, apparently she had another bottle somewhere. But, like, all things being equal, they shouldn't be forcing us to fill in the blanks for them, I would say.
Right, and I think, too, what can always make any drama TV series very, very hard is that you almost have to, you know, force these sort of scenarios together. Mm-hmm. And when you're using examples, like, there's the whole, and we're going to, you know, we're going to talk about the pina colada thing with Coffee Mate. On top of that, so I'm like, that also felt like some interesting timing there with that, you know. But it felt like just overall, just in general, that there was, you know, there was some red hair. It felt more like for this season, instead of a drama, it was almost more like a mystery almost. That's why I'm making a lot of these mystery analogies. Where there was still a lot of drama, but it didn't really feel like season two or season one, where that was more focused on hotel-related issues and drama relating to the hotel. And this one was more, you know, who was the dead body that was in episode one? How did we get to this point? It was a little bit of an offshoot from the prior seasons, but it almost feels like now that's what we're looking for from White Lotus. So it's hard for me to criticize Mike White and be like, hey, he made a bad decision doing some of these things. But
no,
it's
also, I get
it, a tough world too, Rick, as we have seen, where something gets promoted in a TV episode or a series, and a series absolutely blows up. The best analogy I can make was Ginny and Georgia on Netflix, where they made the Taylor Swift joke. And that show, which was probably going to get canceled, got more seasons because of that controversy and had more people watch it.
Yes.
So we're going to see, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see season four and what the decision-making will be in terms of, at least the rumors are it's going to be in South America. We don't know the exact location yet. Now they're still doing location shooting at this point. So we will see. It's going to be if we had to guess something business related or something along those lines. But it felt like, too, that this was more of a tonal shift from season two, in my opinion.
I think it was. I think it definitely was.
And I'm not saying that it wasn't. It didn't do well because of it. It was just more like, it felt more like a mystery whodunit more than what a White Lotus season. Or it's almost like White Lotus decided to do a whodunit and see how that would have worked.
I said to you after the pilot that it was, to me, it was a little bit distracting. You lead with that. You lead with, the young guy sees the dead body floating by and everything like that. Like that was going to be so front of mind the rest of the way for the rest of the series. And it did feel like that was really kind of the case, because in the past two seasons, you saw that there was a death, but I don't know that it necessarily loomed as large over the whole thing here. I like how you classified it as a whodunit, because that's what it felt like. It felt like it was really legitimately a deal where it was built around a lot of misdirection. And I would say that there was a lot of misdirection, because anybody that had pools out there, this would have been like picking all 63 games in the NCAA basketball tournament here. Five people are going to die. Name which five. You know, nobody could have done that based on the way that it went. There were some misdirects in there. And there was a scene in there as well when they were building towards it, when they were building towards the rampage that Rick went on. Although I classify it that way, but he really only shot Jim. I mean, the shootings of the bodyguards were in self-defense. But the whole thing there, and I don't think you ever watched Mad Men, right? Or More Than Bits and Pieces. You did watch it. All right. Okay. So the scene with Amrita where he's trying to appeal to her, like, just please, I got it. Which, you know, again, talk about a transformation from the beginning of the week. The guy didn't change in the ways that were the most important, because he let his demons control him the way it looked like they were going to at the beginning of the week. But by gum, the guy became a believer in therapy, because, you know, that first therapy session that he had, he really put a lot of trust in Amrita. I tell you what this reminded me of. This was Don Draper sitting there with, what's his nuts, the Lane Price, as he's getting ready to fire him. And Lane is trying to get through to him like, you don't understand. My life's over if you do this. I can't go back to England. I can't be a failure. And Don's just like, just reinvent yourself the way that I do. Like, you know, you might not have been getting echoes of that at the time, but as I'm describing it to you now, does that make any sense to you, the comparison of where they put a character in there in a role where you're screaming at the TV like, no, listen to this person, no, and they're not listening to that person and tragic events unfold from it. That's what it reminded me of.
Right, and I think that was very great apropos description there, just not description, but comparison in that case, because, again, I mean, the whole Rick and Chelsea scenario for this entire season was probably, we would argue, probably that'd be the A storyline for most of this thing. Like, you know, you don't cast Walton Goggins and Amy Lou Wood to not do sort of interesting stuff like this. So It was the main storyline. And then we also got to see, you know, Sam Rockwell in arguably one of the greatest, you know, single moments of discussion between a man and another man. So,
yes.
Because of that, I mean, it wasn't really surprising what Rick got to. It's like, again, it was at one point thought that he had finally turned the path. Mm-hmm. And then when he just couldn't, you know, he got confronted again with demons and the demons caught up to him. And we see it all the time, especially in, like, if we talk about this season as almost a season of religion, the season of Eastern mysticism, it's more like, at least in the Buddhist teachings, is always along the lines of trying to focus inward on within yourself, but also at the same point too of focusing on love and focusing on these other things in your life outside of either, whether it was for the Ratliff family, material possessions, or for Belinda, it was more about her life in terms of how she was going to react and rebuild after Tanya had promised her this entire spa scenario. And then also you saw same thing with, like, I talked too, going through his, you know, personal decision making and about losing the gun, and then also in the thing like having to shoot somebody, even though it goes against him, against his religious aspects and discussions. And then we also saw Lachlan's transformation during the season two, and essentially almost near death after drinking that poison smoothie. But it really, this season was more, I think, focused on character building and trying to understand how people work. I would say this season's more about identity than anything else, because we saw a lot of different people's identities change. Like Guy Talk essentially became a bodyguard and then fell in love with Mook. And then we saw, you know, Sarah Catherine Hook's character very apropos and being focused in on trying to have to learn this more of spirituality, but being held back by her prior personal, you know, views and not officially understanding the real transformation of seeing yourself as focused on one singular focus in terms of religion, to where you have to make sacrifices, and she wasn't really ready to make them. I feel like Mike White kind of went with a little bit of a Gen Z angle of, well, we want to do this thing, but we also at the same point don't want to give up our creature comforts at the end of the day as well. And I mean, yes. I felt like too, the one thing that I would have loved to see was something a little bit more definitive and a character change from the Rattler family, from Tim. I felt like he didn't learn anything throughout this entirety. It's like he nearly tried to kill himself after all these problems that he had with his business. Mm-hmm. And he does learn like to live together as a family. And you see changes from Saxon and Lachlan and Piper as well throughout the season. And same thing with their mom on some level. Because again, you have to give Parker Posey credit. She created another great character. And essentially it's this whole focus, at least with their family, it's like the identity is money. Yeah. And at the end of the day is after, you know, they go home, the money's going to be gone. But that was the one thing I felt like it was a little unsatisfying to me at the end of the day. It's like, if we wanted to, like, there was I would say they were the B storyline of the season. Mm-hmm. And it felt like we never really got a true resolution at the end of the day. And outside of like some minor things that Saxon had learned, and outside of, you know, minor things that Piper had learned and Lachlan, mm-hmm. and like, they're just, it like, we weren't really given a full answer. And again, I would also note too, that could be intentional by Mike White. It would not shock me if maybe one of those family members get brought back into a future season. Mm-hmm. So it's just a big focus in on identity and religion. And it felt like there were some storylines that we got payoffs for, but the rest of them were just kind of characters running around doing things.
Yeah. And ultimately, if you consider the Ratliffs to be the B storyline, would you consider the A storyline to be Rick and Chelsea?
Yeah, I would say Rick and Chelsea's A. B would be the Ratliffs. C would probably be the girls' trip, essentially. Mm-hmm. And D would be Belinda's storyline with her son Zion, and then also mm-hmm. you would probably say Mook and Guy Talk storyline is probably the storyline at the end of the day. But the thing that has made this finale, though, just to jam-pack all this stuff in at the end, mm-hmm. that can make it successful and unsuccessful. We've seen just overall, it got insane ratings. It got a 6.5, highest for any White Lotus episode ever on HBO. And again, that could be inflated due to the, to HBO Max and all these other things. So it would not surprise me that, and again, too, like this was a more, you know, and we see this with TV shows all the time. It's especially now we're seeing it more with Severance now, too, that when everyone just loves a show, like the branding is on point, there's so many advertisements for The White Lotus. And it felt like this was one of those seasons where it's a funny irony of it, too, right? Because like we talk about identity is one of the major storylines for the season, and just on the flip side, we have to ask what the identity of the White Lotus show is right now going into a season 4. Are we going to see another sort of whodunit season, or are we going to go back to sort of season 2 where it's more about interpersonal relationship and character building more than anything else?
That is a good question. Mike White and his remarks that were released afterwards said something about he sees season 4 is potentially being waves crashing against the shore or against the wall, I guess, but that may not literally be the case because they may actually take this one inland. So whether it be somewhere in Europe or whatever, and there's thought that maybe it'll be a cold weather or cooler weather season 4, but you know, maybe like a winter type resort. A lot to unpack in what you said there. Out of the E storyline, arguably, of Guy Talk and Mook, I saw some clever person on Reddit, a guy talked at it all for the Mookie, as Fred Durst might say. But I mean, I'm just speculating because I've never spent a moment in my life, contrary to what some might believe, in any 4chan incel forums here. Wouldn't know where to find them. But I'm guessing Mook is probably a real hate figure in there, because doesn't she seem like the type of gal that the red pill folks are always screaming about? Doesn't that seem like basically how they wrote her, as to be like a resentment figure for incels, because she's just pushing this poor guy into all this other stuff? And there were people on Reddit that were like, well, she's a poor person in a poor country, and she's just trying to get ahead. You know, like, there's a way to look at it that way, but they never at any point in the season presented her as being any type of sympathetic figure, really. I mean, not necessarily somebody that you're meant to hate, unless you are an incel, but as far as, like, always, you know, trying to reinforce whatever his worst instincts were. And as soon as he shoots this guy in the back, oh, hey, he's a big hero. He gets the job here. He gets the girl. He gets all these kind of things. So season three being about the rewarding of evil, basically, if you want to call it, you know, that, whether Greg Gary getting away with his stuff, Belinda getting corrupted, you know, there's a whole lot in this here. There was a movie some years ago, I think it was called Arlington Road, where it was one where it was a Tim Robbins movie, and it was like the single biggest example I've ever seen of, like, the, you know, unhappy diarrhea ending for the audience. And I'm not saying it's the same thing here, but it's the thing as far as, like, bad people getting over. I think you do have to put Mook in that category. I wouldn't hate on her as much as the incels would, but I mean, they didn't write her to be a sympathetic character. That's for darn sure.
Right. And kind of in a weird way too. Like, it was kind of shocking that, because I had seen this also on Reddit and X as well, as that Lisa Mandeville is one of the most famous female musical artists on the planet right now. It's kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. They gave her a role with really nothing to do. Like, she was just there for most of this thing, and she had to be, you know, it felt like, and we discussed earlier on, is that they had 3, 5, 6 storylines going on all the time. So it felt like character-wise, there were going to be some balls dropped, just how it works. Mm-hmm. And it just, at the end of the day, it was kind of nice to see a scenario where, you know, Guy Talk was able to finally get what he wanted, but then he also lost a bit of his soul along the line too, because he had to shoot someone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he got what he wanted at the end of the day, but then again, it just shows how, it's the same thing with Lynn's character, about how money corrupts people, and you turn away from it. And there were many parts where I think one of the major underlying themes of the season too was essentially getting what you are allowed to, getting it too. Like, there are very few instances overall where identity was not changed for any of the characters. Like, there are so many changes that it's really hard to just even go through them all, because there are just so many characters and so many storylines. And it felt like, again, we'll see what happens if Mike decides to stay with the course of these many storylines, but I have a feeling it might get dialed back, because the reviews, at least, have not been kind in relation to all of these different storylines getting wrapped up in the finale.
It is, and again, I don't think, you know, certainly we're not overall hating on this as much as it sounds like we might be from time to time. Yeah. You and I are just going to be, we're going to notice the things that kind of, like, jump out at us a little bit here. All in all, I thought it was a excellent season of the White Lotus. And again, you know, any season of the White Lotus is better than most of the things that are on TV. So we start with that stipulation. But as far as it goes here too, with the whole corruption angle of this whole thing, there were a number of folks some episodes back that called it, that Belinda was going to be a sellout to Greg Gary and end up being somebody that would take the money. Now, it ended up being her son that was the devil on the shoulder and really kind of pushed that angle there. And so that was something where the way that it unfolded, and then, of course, her doing to good old Pornshy the same thing that had been done to her, as far as when Tanya had kicked her to the curb. Ironical in that she ends up, you know, taking the blood money from Tanya's estate. But this is something where you can take one of the great things about this, with the intersection of the different storylines here, was Belinda insisting there, and like now that she had her money and everything like that, oh, I'm going to go get my son, you know, a therapy thing here, whatever. So she's so busy playing big shot, getting her son a therapy thing that she can now comfortably pay for. In the end, that's partially responsible for what ended up happening here. Because again, I'm not saying that necessarily had Rick been able to go for that therapy session here, had he been able to sit down, you know, and be able to go through this, that, you know, and have another session there, that it would have ended up being any different. It's very possible he sees Jim going by and loses his shiznit anyways. But that's one of those things where they don't really beat you over the head with it. But Belinda's decision, it was not only a thing there where, again, she insisted all along that she was morally better than to do what she ended up doing in the end. But however indirectly, there's some blood on her hands for that. Because had the therapist not been in a position of where she had to insist, no, 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 I have to attend to this client now, who's to say that basically Rick probably wouldn't have at least been on scene when Jim was there. He wouldn't have had everything thrust in his face the way that he did, which was what ultimately sent him over the edge.
Right, and I feel like, too, and we, Belinda's storyline this season wasn't exactly a strong one, and it wasn't shocking to see in a about face, because it's a trope. We all know this trope, right?
Right.
Where the morally upstanding person sells their soul for money. Like, that's a trope that goes on as long as time at this point. And it was really interesting to see how Belinda was able to turn on a dime and make that decision making. And, you know, it does bring up the cautionary stories that in our own lives, just as general, it's like we will sell our souls just for money on some level.
Right.
And it feels like we just have to also discuss, like, within this season of White Lotus, is if where is finding where religion plays within your life, or how things are, how, where your identity as a person. So we are all multifaceted people just as individuals. And especially with T, and I think the one thing that White Lotus did really well this year was showing that everyone has multifaceted sides to them. Because we see a lot in TV these days, characters being very one-note. And the one thing I will never criticize Mike White for is not having a diverse cast of characters, along with the fact, too, that he is always willing to look at the darker sides of emotion and character studies and all these things. So it feels like there's a lot to play up in season four if they do bring anyone back from this season. And it feels like, too, at the end of the day, that storyline-wise, Belinda character did a turnabout face. We saw throughout the season a lot of characters change their mind. I mean, Piper changed her mind on a dime, too, despite, you know, being very adamant through most of the season that she was ready to do this.
Yeah.
But then she fell to the same fault issues that all of us do, which is we say we want to stay at the Buddhist monastery, but we also want to stay at the Buddhist monastery in the, you know, in the Shangri-La suite at that period of time. And again, it's the discussion of this season too. Money was another big key line about too. And again, too, is that was also part of the one of the storylines with the girls, is that essentially, you know, at the end of the day, you know, like Jacqueline is paying for most of this trip. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see how, you know, in a game with the Rattler family, about how they're going to react to money, them essentially losing their money at some point. But again, we never got the payoff for that. So it's for now, in mind's eye, we're going to have to make our own recollection. That's what good TV does.
It allows
you to paint the picture in your head after the fact.
That's the power dynamics of it. That's absolutely right. And it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, Piper, sort of a parallel, I mean, in a way that wasn't damaging to anybody else the way that Belinda was indirectly with the whole Rick mass murder situation here. Or again, Rick killed three people, but really the bodyguards were in self-defense after he killed Jim. But Piper didn't hurt anybody but herself, potentially, in kind of going back on this whole thing. She's still a very confused individual. But you talk about tropes, and there were a bunch of them in the show here. And again, that's not necessarily to be critical, but the whole thing of, another one that you can lard in there is Chelsea with the whole thing of, I can fix him. Oh, I can fix him. And that didn't last, you know, long. It did. They had what appeared to be a bit of a happy ending there, a reconciliation, but all the while it was still kind of like, why aren't you getting out of the resort? Like, how did Rick not have the whole kind of sense of self-preservation to get her out of there. And it was interesting, too, that, like, you know, in the very end, you know, they didn't go for the cliche of as she's lying there dead or dying or whatever it was. He didn't tell her that he loved her then. So, I mean, hey, the guy died the way that he lived, never telling her that he loved her, at least on camera. So, but you had her with the I can fix him kind of a trope. You had the women with the different angles of the cattiness here, the women in the friends group here as well. And then for Tim, it was the whole trope of, you know, he's going to go, you know, Jonestown on his family here just to kind of get them out of the situation. And they would show the wheels start turning every time here, like, oh, geez, I got to kill Saxon, too. He can't live without this. Oh, geez, Piper, that's the one I really didn't want to have to off, but I'm going to have to off her now. And then he seemed very relieved when Lachlan was like, yeah, no, I think I can do without this stuff. And then it ended up almost being the trope of he killed the son that, you know, the one that he really wanted to spare out of the whole bunch. And it was quite a twist when they showed that he lived, because I was watching the breakdown that they did subsequently on The Ringer, and they noted, like, you look at what was in that blender, there was enough of that stuff in that blender to have killed him. If we're to take this at face value, you know, the suicide tree, whatever, which, by the way, it might be a good thing if Pam wasn't helpfully letting some of these potentially depressed guests know, like, hey, you know, this is poison. This will kill people. Maybe you don't want, you know, or at the very least, get the poison trees out of there. But there were a bunch of tropes, but I will say on balance, I feel like they were judiciously used. I'm not going to slam him for the use of them. The other one, though, being the one that might have come the closest to the edge of potentially being a little bit corny, the whole thing of, you know, Jim never got a chance with his dying breath to say, Rick, I am your father. But, you know, instead his wife ends up saying it. So that was something that had been speculated on Reddit. Was he the real father? And then that goes back to his earlier comments here, too. You didn't miss anything. Your dad was a scumbag, which instead of being an insult towards his dad was actually self-awareness, as it comes across later on. But there were a bunch of tropes, but I feel like they were used, you know, well, as far as telling the story. And I don't feel like any of them were particularly overbearing.
Right. And I think, again, this is drama TV. Like, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. You're going to have tropes. You're going to have these sort of scenarios. And it felt like, too, like, taking also a step back, too, from just the hotel staff characters, there just wasn't much for them to do this season. And, you know, Fabian had a little bit of his moment in the sun very briefly, but that got overtaken by the girls having a disagreement. So, mm-hmm. And then a lot of the other characters just felt like they were characters. They were just there at the end of the day. And it felt like to maybe we'll see a change in season 4, because the season 1 and season 2, they put a lot of power in the hotel staff, and it felt like this season they were just sort of window dressing for most of it. Essentially, they were there to add plot points and keys and all these other things, and the whole nature of how, you know, we as a society treat hotel staff, and just it felt like there was a little bit more in seasons 1 and 2 about having them as more dynamic characters instead of this season, which was pretty much everyone was almost one note hotel staff related.
Yeah, and then you know, Valentine,
I talk in maybe you know, outside, I'm trying to, I mean, outside of maybe Guy Talk and maybe Valentine, that's really about it for this.
Yeah, and even Valentine was a situation where you know, he was, you know, more so sort of an appendage to the women's storyline and everything like that. They end up adding the extra beats to the story as far as him and his friends being behind the very violent robbery at the resort and some of the other aspects of it here, too, and where he's trying to shake down the women, you know, that are there like, oh, hey, take pity on me. Some, you know, send money to my quote unquote family in Ukraine and all that kind of stuff. But it is it's kind of funny the way that went. And there was an angle that they didn't go with of where Carrie's character maybe might have been a little bit more, you know, sympathetic towards, you know, Jacqueline at that point in time. Or maybe, you know, maybe I'm not being generous enough, and maybe it played a role in Carrie, you know, kind of humbling herself towards Jacqueline and Kate as far as, Did Jacqueline swoop in on somebody that she wanted to get with? Yeah, but that wasn't a very good idea in the first place, as was subsequently. So is it a no harm, no foul if somebody blocks you on a situation that would have turned out to be a bad choice? I don't know, because I still go by it's the thought that counts, and your friend tried to block you and grab him for herself. So, yeah, but you're right that they were basically sort of just kind of, you know, devices in the overall plots going on at the resort as opposed to anything else. And that's a thing where, and even with Pornshy, with, you know, Belinda, that was just a thing to basically set it up that he's the new Belinda at the end of the day here. He's the one that gets kicked to the curb when she gets, in this case, the payday. In the case of season one, it was Tanya with Greg, the new love interest at the time. And so when you look at this, I think, again, there were a lot of different aspects that people put expectations on coming into this season. When you look at this powerhouse cast that was there, and I think at the end of the day, I mean, you're hearing a lot of people speculating about some of these actors and actresses being up for awards. Amy Lou Wood was certainly a breakout star of this season. Parker Posey. This is certainly worthy of a lot of the other roles that she's played in the course of her career. Carrie Coon, who I greatly enjoyed in another anthology, Fargo Season 3. And interestingly enough, in the last episode, she gave a very powerful monologue. And I'm told that she's done that in other shows, that it's sort of a tradition that in the last episode, Carrie Coon gives a powerful monologue. So she got to do that there, even if I somewhat kind of question a little bit of the content of the monologue. She did a great job as an actress. She conveyed all of the uncertainties and insecurities and everything like that that her character was carrying around. But the one where through the course of the season, particularly on Reddit, where people were questioning if the writing was up to the caliber of the actor, and you probably know who I'm going to say on this already, is Walton Goggins, because he was pretty much just a blank expression kind of a guy through like episodes one and two. And he starts to get fleshed out a little bit more as it goes along. And I think by the end, I think it was definitely a circumstance. And I mean, and again, in the last two episodes in particular, as he is thrust with the reality of Jim being there, you know, the facial acting and everything like that. I feel like they built to where, okay, we're getting the Walton Goggins basically that we paid for as viewers figuratively. So I feel like it got to that point. There are probably still some folks on Reddit who feel like it never got to that point. But in the end, I felt like it was a role worthy of Walton Goggins, even if it took a while to get there. And again, I say that as one of the world's biggest Walton Goggins marks.
Right. And again, like with any sort of anthology show with multiple storylines, there's going to be a payoff, and we did get that in the finale. And mm-hmm. we saw his character essentially kind of gain steam throughout the season, and just seeing how all these situations play themselves out with Rick, and just, you know, his, you know, clear love for Chelsea on some level, but then also his love of revenge too was also a big component of the season. And Walton Goggins is obviously one of the more talented actors that we have these days. And there was a reason why they hired him to do this role, because there's very few people who could probably have played this role with right. some level of earnest and sincerity to it, but still also be able to turn on a dime like he can in some of the roles that he's had in recent TV shows and movies.
Yeah, and he did a very great job of conveying the nuance of it, because he was a character that, particularly when you dug below the surface here and you saw what motivated him, he got to be more sympathetic. But like at the end of the day, he was still a guy where, best case scenario, as you're judging this guy, best case scenario, extraordinarily inconsiderate. So he gets his friend Frank to inadvertently, but still nevertheless, to fall off the wagon, just leaves him behind in Bangkok, and maybe he figures he's happier in his natural state of affairs. Who knows? Maybe he could justify that way. Never called Chelsea from the resort to say, hey, let's get our asses out of here. Let's get on the next plane out before Jim and his wife get back to the resort. Kind of left her hanging. That didn't play out badly for her immediately, but it couldn't have played out worse as it went along, as they end up being two of the five dead bodies in the end there. So it was a great amount of nuance. Where I will disagree with you slightly is I feel like the Ratliffs were kind of the one storyline. Rick and Chelsea, I would say 1A or 2 or whatever. So I would flip-flop those two because I think they were front and center because of the nuances there with the different characters. You take Saxon at the beginning of the thing, and I was just, I got to admit, like I was kind of laughing at the writing, and I'm just like, what kind of like sixth grade message board did they start scrolling to write this guy's dialogue, right? Like I've been around some real douchey people, but I've never been around anybody that talks quite like Saxon. It just didn't ring true. They were trying so hard to just make him the old, you know, all talk, no action sex pest. But the way that it ended up going, the character growth with him, the journey that Lachlan went along in the last episode here. Well, it just, I guess if I'm guilty of anything, it's being a people pleaser. I wouldn't use that as a justification for what he did. But then Piper kind of exposing the whole thing, like, you know, in the end, she's just somebody with a white girl savior complex and somebody who thought she was better than her family, but proved not to be. Parker Posey again. What can you say about this? I mean, she was sort of the new Tanya as far as a character that just kind of, you know, just swallowed every scene that she was in. She just, I mean, and if Walton Goggins's face on listening to Sam Rockwell's story is the number one meme coming out of this, the number two meme is Parker Posey's face as she's giving a hug to her daughter in the last episode, trying not to just, you know, bust out, you know, in happy tears or whatever, you know, just barely keeping it within. But, and then Tim, a surprising journey for him because, and I suppose that again, all the fake outs, the visions of death, whatever, I guess we should have known that it wasn't necessarily going to go that way. Although a lot of the foreboding in season two with a lot of the images of death and everything like that did end up playing out pretty viciously in the case of Tanya. And first, before that, the whole boat of gaze that she shot before she went off the edge of the boat. This time around, it was just a fake out as far as that. But him being on the boat there with the family riding back, he's ready to face the music. And again, I think that's a thing where we can look at it like that was his reaction upon getting Lachlan back. He thought that his idiocy had killed his own son. And he was just so grateful that his son was alive and that he hadn't ended up killing anybody, that he was ready to face the music. But like his moment of contemplation on the boat there, I thought that was one of the better payoffs of the season because that really was a full character arc that he went along through the course of the season, because you see why a guy like him would think, I can't go back and face this. And then increasingly through the course of this, neither can my family because they're not built to withstand it either. But the moment of clarity that he has on the boat there, knowing how bad it's going to be, and as they're looking at their phones, they can immediately tell that it's bad. That was a payoff that I thought was some of the best writing of the show, I thought.
Right, and I think the whole character study of that family was very apropos of the timeline that we're in. And again, there's always discussion regarding class, especially because this is a show where you have obscenely rich people going to these hotels because they can afford to. And I think that's just going to be one of the things that is sort of a marker for the season. Was also to, like, Jason Isaacs is probably due for one of those awards too, just in terms of the breadth of his character throughout the season, even though most of it was sort of the portrayal of a guy who was on the edge and had to, you know, be medically induced to get through this season. But also he saw a lot of growth throughout the season too. Like, while most of his family kind of essentially stayed the same, I would say maybe outside of Saxon, like, he showed some real growth and he understood and was open to scenarios, like, for example, that his wife necessarily wasn't in. We are going to see in future seasons of White Lotus this sort of character study of having a life-altering moment impact your life and then how you react to it. And that's why I think Mike White gains a lot of credentials as a writer and creator of a series like this, because there wasn't really a lot of shows like this when he was creating this series at this time, because it's always hard to write for characters and it's hard to write an anthology series just from the amount of time that you have with each of the actors and actresses and in terms of building these storylines on a season by season basis. So you have to give him credit for what he was able to do with season 3, even if the reviewers might think it's not as good as other seasons, or fans at the same point.
Yeah. He did an incredible job. It was a really, really tremendous season. And that's a thing where, again, it's a high standard to continue to live up to, because he's created this very unique franchise that guys like me and you really love and enjoy getting to see every time it comes back. The one person who I'm sure didn't love the way that it ended, if you listened closely enough last night, because there is this tendency a lot of times actors and actresses will really come to sympathize with their characters. If you listened closely enough last night when the show was airing live, you probably could have heard the screeches at the very end from Jennifer Coolidge, who made no bones about this, that she wanted the Greg Gary character to pay the price. And, you know, this guy lives to be skeevy another day here. It didn't end happily. And unfortunately, it's hard to write a scenario where he probably ever does. How do you contrive to get him at another White Lotus resort subsequently here? So this was probably it. This was the window for this guy having to face the music. And it looks like in the universe of this show, it came and went.
Yeah. And then it's one of those sad truths of reality that if you have the money, you can get out of almost any situation if you need to. And it's also, I would say, it's the archetype too of that. At some point, you also have to atone for the mistakes you made in the past. And at the same point, too, that was part of his character study, too. And eventually, he had to pay the price at the end. But still, at the end, as we saw, he still has a gorgeous girlfriend and a great mansion in Thailand. And essentially, it goes back to that whole sort of diatribe that Walton Goggins' character, Rick, had when meeting his father about, you know, what have you done well for the country? And it felt like, too, that he's very similar to what we saw early on the boat scenes, where you have these characters who are essentially expats living a lavish lifestyle on the back of a lot of other hardworking individuals. And it feels like that's a critique of the series, and we're going to see these sort of plot lines and future seasons of the show as well.
We're going to. And this is not necessarily, I don't necessarily like to lift from what other shows have done, but I do feel the need to do this from what I saw at the end of the Ringer review of this, which I think I probably would have gravitated towards this anyways, just out of curiosity, but ranking the three seasons of this. I'll go first. I have said that I think that season two of The White Lotus is tied with Fargo season two for the greatest anthologies of all time. So I'm going to keep White Lotus season two in first place among the seasons. I had to go back and just kind of review through Wikipedia season one of The White Lotus. And I felt like each of the six episodes was it had more sort of oomph to it. And I feel like the six-episode format really kind of played more to the strengths than the eight-episode one did. So I consider it to be almost a coin flip. But I'm going 2-1-3 in that order. I find three to be, like I said, very close to one, but I am putting it in third place. How would you rank them?
I would go 2-3-1. I just felt like season one was one of those beginning border seasons. And I feel like in the totality of a lot of things, I don't remember a lot about season one, to be honest. Like, there are much more key storylines and key plot points in these future seasons. But again, we may have to review. I may be a little bit hip, maybe critical of season one after not seeing it and so on. But I also just felt like a lot of the characters in that season were kind of one note in comparison to future seasons in general.
Yeah, and, you know, with the three different themes that you had, the theme this season of spirituality, the theme of season two with sex, the theme of season one of class, I kind of agree with you that there were some class caricatures that they had in season one, both on the high class and the lower economic class end, too, like, you know, like the poor Hawaiian guy at the resort with the indigenous, you know, family that's put upon, you know. So, yeah, so I do think it was a little bit, you're probably right, it was a little stereotypical with some of the class characterizations they had of the characters in season one. Nevertheless, I'm going to say season one by just a slight kind of an edge here. But in terms of our breakdown of season three and the season three finale of The White Lotus, anything else that kind of jumps out at you that we didn't cover yet?
I mean, one of the questions I did want to ask you too, Rick, is, and I think it's going to be a question that everyone is going to have on their mind, is which character is going to get brought back for season four? Who would you like to see get brought back for season four?
I got to tell you, it was an odd kind of a thing when I was watching the Ringer review of it. Like, they were focusing on Saxon for some reason. They had some fascination with bringing Saxon back. I'm just like, out of all of these characters, like, I don't know. The obvious one would be Victoria. And I've seen some people doing the headcanon thing of, like, that Victoria is either going to find a new guy once Tim goes away, or imagine a thing, imagine like a destination wedding, whatever, of where Victoria tries to marry off Piper to a rich guy. So I think something involving Victoria and something involving the post-Tim foibles there, I think that's how I like to see it go for season four. What would you say?
For me, yeah, I would be pro that. Piper getting brought back would be very interesting, because I feel like Mike White still has a payoff that he still needs to do with the Rattler family, and she seems like the most likely character. Another one too is Zion. Obviously, is probably going to be very, very interesting moving forward with Belinda getting the $5 million. So, it could be a very interesting move if he was potentially impeached, because it feels like, to me at least, Rick, the Belinda storyline's kind of wrapped up here. But Zion, a very interesting character, probably. I got to give big credit to Nicholas Dufresne, the actor who played him. Like, he was a powerhouse in that finale.
He was. And it was a thing where it really was kind of a fake out, because in the I think it was the cold open, actually, of the pilot. But very early on in the pilot, when they're showing you the flash forward here, as he's going through the therapy session, he's coming off as being kind of a meek kind of a young man, and somebody that was like a little bit uncertain of himself, whatever. And like, he was somebody that had the balls to, go through this whole thing on behalf of his mom previously. So maybe that was, we all have these things where sometimes there's like an out of body experience where like we're able to summon these things up if it's important enough. And to be able to summon up a once in a lifetime payday for his mom, maybe that was him sort of going outside his comfort zone, and maybe what we saw in the therapy thing was sort of the real thing. But that just makes me agree with you all the more so that it would be interesting, because if I'm right, that's something he learned about himself. That's a side of himself that you didn't see when he was in the therapy thing here. And maybe he's kind of seeing himself as somebody that has the potential to maybe do this. So that's a thing where it could be him and Belinda, if they have more that they want to explore there, because I don't think she's starting a spa. I think she's taking the $5 million and doing like whatever with it. So you could see maybe like those two on a future trip and maybe trying to wine and dine somebody to do business with them or something. That could be very interesting.
Yeah. And I also think another sort of character that they could also bring into is, again, it was just only a guest voice, but Kihei Kwan was the voice of, essentially the Kenny Wynn, Timothy's former business partner.
So yes.
I could totally see a scenario where he, took a deal and is now living in a different country. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. It's going to be very interesting. Also, just in terms of like, it wouldn't shock me that we could potentially see another character that was sort of off screen for most of it, but Jacqueline's husband was also omnipresent on this show, and he could definitely come into a season four or a future season at some point.
Yeah.
Because it was awesome. Sprinkled into there, and there was this, that he was one of the only characters who essentially had very minimal speaking time, but his storyline was discussed consistently. So it's not shocking if they brought him in at some point in the future.
That could be interesting. Overall, I think I keep gravitating most to something that would involve Victoria again, because I feel like that character is the new Tanya, of like the one that just grabs you, steals every scene that she's in, and I don't even know if steals is the right word, dominates, but this larger than life force. I think she's heir to the throne basically of Tanya, because Tanya was that character that just dominated everywhere that she was. And that's the same kind of a thing. Victoria's energy is a little bit more low key, largely because she's drugged up half the time. But just the energy that she's able to emit is just so hilarious, and just grabs you by the lapel and shakes you. Like, I'm not ready to let go of her as a character yet. So that would be truly fascinating. But yeah, there's a lot of different ways that they can go. You know, they're going to bring back one of these characters. Maybe it'll be Lachlan coming out of what he's learned after this stuff here too. You never know. But it is always a great pleasure to be able to break down the great shows of TV with you, Ben Chu. Also to break down, as we more normally do, the NBA with you and your role as FDH Hoops analyst. And before you know it, we'll be doing our playoff preview for 2024-2025 for the NBA. But always a pleasure, Ben Chu. Thank you so much for being here today, my man.
Well, I appreciate it, Rick. Justice for Porn Shot.
Yes, yes.
We want
justice for Porn Shot. Yes. Yes, we do. And I don't think we're going to get it, though. But that's a guy that certainly deserved better. But we will hey, maybe he'll be a guy that shows up in a subsequent season. No, you never know.
That probably would not shock me enough.
Maybe we've not seen the last of him. So we'll have to wait and see. But White Lotus season 4, I think we'll be on top of that when it happens as well. And I can't wait for that to happen. But thank you very much, Ben Chu. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for this live mini episode of the FDH Lounge, mini episode 1822.